If the reason for creating man was for his station in this world, it would not have been necessary to blow into him neshama, kolka chashuva velyona, so important and lofty, that it is greater than the angels themselves. Kol shekein, surely the fact she ain't motzas shum nachas ruach, surely the fact that she finds no enjoyment b'chol in nugei ze olam, in all of the pleasures of this world. And this is what our sages have taught us in Kohelis, zulashonim gam nefesh lo timolei, and the nefesh, the soul, will not be filled. Moshul ma'adav adomer, to what this can be compared, Lironi Shanasa Basmelach, to a peasant who married a princess. Im Yavila Komasher Ba'olam, if this peasant brings her everything in the world, Einim Chashuvim La, they're not important to her. Why? Shehi Basmelach, because she is a princess. Kacha Nefesh, so too is the soul. Ilo Evesola Komadne Olam, if you would bring to it all of the pleasures of this world, Eino Klumla, they mean nothing to a Lama. Shehi Men Al Yonim, because she is from the upper world. Have you ever heard of something called Jewish guilt? Guilt. Now, if you're a student of the counterculture revolution of the 60s, you know that guilt is bad. Guilt is an annoying sort of thing that takes away my happiness, that won't let me flourish, that just inhibits me, constricts me, and doesn't let me be me. Well, the reality is that guilt is not just not a negative. Guilt is a very important part of the human. And when we understand the human, and we understand where guilt comes from, we'll understand that it's actually a very significant part of the way Hashem created the human. And to focus on that, I'd like to share with you an interesting example. When we become adults, we tend to hide ourselves, we tend to mask, but children are transparent. You could read through them like a book. I remember when my oldest daughter was about 5, maybe 6 years old, she would oftentimes like to have a cookie. And it sometimes would happen that she would take a cookie when she wasn't supposed to. And my wife would look her in the eye and say, "Sir Leah, did you take a cookie from the cookie jar?" "No, mommy, I didn't." My wife knew the truth. My wife would say, "Sir Leah, did you take a cookie that you weren't supposed to?" "No, mommy, I didn't." My wife would look her in the eye, and invariably, within 5, 6, 7 seconds, there'd be a sort of looking down and a kind of shy sort of smile would come across her face, and she would say the words, "Yes, mommy, I did." Now, I want you to understand, to a 5-year-old girl, taking the cookie was very important, and not letting mommy know that she took the cookie was also very important. Yet she couldn't lie. You see, when she said the words, "No, I didn't take the cookie," and her mother looked her in the eyes, inside of her was a voice that said, "You can't lie to mommy. It's not true." And though she desperately wanted to hold to the lie, she couldn't, because that voice inside her said, "You can't lie to mommy. It's not true." And the truth came out. When we mature, we start developing an ability to not listen to that voice. You see, that voice is my pure neshama. That voice is everything within the human that wants to do what's right, what's good, what's proper. And that voice is the ultimate directional signal and the ultimate processing power to guide me to what's right and what's proper. Every human being has an internal navigational system that lets them know what's right, what's proper. And that voice inside speaks very, very clearly. As we mature, we learn to quash that voice. We learn to squish it. We learn to ignore it. We learn to push it down. But interestingly enough, that voice is always there. As an example, they're no longer as popular as they used to be, but there's something called a lie detector test, a polygraph. In the good old days, it was used for criminal activity. I remember a number of years ago, there were certain things going on in the yeshiva. There was some things that were being taken, and they brought in a private investigator to give a fellow a lie detector test to see whether he was the person involved in these string of genevas. In any case, the way a lie detector test works is they put the monitors on the arm, and they're measuring to see if there's a change in heart rate and blood pressure, etc. So the fellow who was administering the test began with a series of baseline questions. Just to get a reading, he would ask some innocuous questions. Where do you go to school? What grade are you in? How old are you? Do you have a girlfriend? Shoom! All of a sudden, a needle shot up. You see, when he asked what time it was, when he asked what day it was, There was a baseline reading that was here. The minute he asked the question, do you have a girlfriend, the needle shot up. You see, the person administering the test didn't realize that this was a yeshiva, and that was a big no-no, but the person being asked the question sure did. But here's the surprising part. The person being asked the question said the word no. But inside him, there was a response that said, that's a lie. And there was a physiological response because there were two voices inside, one saying yes and one saying no. And this has been proven time after time. They'll take a hardened criminal. They'll bring him into a room and they'll ask him a series of questions, and throughout the baseline remains, the needle remains where it should be. And then they start asking the questions, where were you on the 15th at night? Where were you at 12 o'clock? Did you ever see this person? All of a sudden those needles start shooting up higher and higher. But here's the strange part. This person has told that lie over and over and over. I was home in bed. I wasn't near the mansion. I didn't go anywhere near the person. I never met him before. He may have said that lie to the DA. He may have said that lie hundreds of times. And certainly in his heart of hearts, he wants to masquerade. He wants to hide those facts. But while he may say those words, within him there's a voice that says, it's not true. You were there. You did steal that object. You are the guilty party. And there's a conflict, an inner conflict between two voices, one that demands what's honest, what's right, what's proper, and the other one that says, quiet down, I'm in charge here. And there's a conflict that has a physiological response. You can measure it based on his heart rate, based on his blood pressure, and that is an interesting manifestation of this voice inside. Guilt is a manifestation of a part of me that says what I'm doing isn't right. What I'm doing, I'm not happy with. Why did I do that? I shouldn't be doing that kind of thing. It's not proper for a person of my stature. And if you'd like to know what guilt is, guilt is that voice inside that says, I'm not happy with you. I mean, you're not happy with me. I'm not happy with you. What are you, my mother-in-law? You're not happy? Yeah, I'm not happy with you. Leave me alone. I'm doing my thing. I'm making money. I'm enjoying myself. Yeah, but why are you doing that? It's selfish. It's mean. It's nasty. There's a story told about Henry Ford. Henry Ford is known as the inventor, the father of modern assembly line technology. But Henry Ford was not known to be a great humanitarian. As a matter of fact, he used to brag that he never did anything for anyone but himself. One day he was walking in the fields with a friend of his, and there were some yelps coming from far away from a dog that got caught in a barbed wire fence. Henry Ford walked over to the barbed wire fence, gently removed the barb from the dog, freeing the dog to run out. The friend turns to Henry Ford and says, wait a minute, I thought you were the guy who never did anything for anyone but himself. Henry Ford looked at this fellow and said, that was for me. The dog's yelps were bothering me. Now that's an interesting example of a person whose soul shrivels up like a prune. But even there, there's a voice inside that says, do something. There's an animal in pain. Do something to help. Do something to alleviate its pain. Henry Ford didn't care. Henry Ford spent decades trying to squash that voice, trying to quell it, and trying to quiet it down. But within him was programmed a desire to help, to be good, to be magnanimous, to be generous, and he couldn't squash it. And no matter how perverse a human being is, no matter how deviant they become, that voice remains and it speaks. And if you'd like to see an unhappy person, watch a person in conflict with himself. Watch a person who cheats in business or cheats the system or whatever it may be, and you'll see a person who's tormented. Oh, he looks very happy now, but when he lies his head on the pillow at night, and if it's not tonight, it'll be in 2 weeks or in 2 months or in 20 years, there's an annoying voice inside of, ugh. Ugh, what did you do? What do you mean, what did I do? I made a lot of money. Yeah, but what did you do? What do you mean, what did I do? I made a fortune. This is great. Yeah, but you're not honest. You're lying. You're stealing. So what? I'm making money. Who cares? Come on, I'm ashamed of you. What do you mean you're ashamed of me? I'm proud. No, I'm ashamed of you. And that voice will bother him and bother him. It will keep on gnawing at him because that voice is a part of me. And one of the great chidushim in understanding the human is the fact that you can't run from that voice. You can't hide from it. You can't run from it because that voice is you. That's the part of you that desires to accomplish, to grow, to change yourself and change the world. And if you live your life in some frivolous, passing manner. What's going to happen is that voice is going to well up within you, and it's going to bother you, and it's going to keep on saying, why don't you grow? Why don't you accomplish? Why aren't you doing for other people? What do you mean for other people? I got me to take care of. Yeah, but you're selfish. So who cares if I'm selfish? Yeah, but you do it just for you. And that voice will go on and on. And if you'd like to see an unhappy person, study a person who dedicates his life to his self-fulfillment by reaching in and gratifying every one of his desires. You see, not only will he not have more pleasure that way, but he'll be incredibly miserable. Why? Because within him there's a voice that will constantly gnaw at him, constantly bother him, and say to him, why aren't you doing for others? Why aren't you accomplishing? Why are you so shallow? Why? And if you'd like to see a human being in utter misery, watch a tormented person. And that is the reality. We don't spend an awful lot of time studying the person called I, but when you become self-aware, you recognize that Hashem did a very grand job at creating the human. I'll share with you what I mean. My daughters play the piano. And they all begin at the stage when they're young. Now, if you've ever heard a six-year-old play the piano, it's a very torturesome sound. It goes something like this, dun, 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 dun. My wall-filled room is adjacent to the piano. Here's the piano, here's the wall, and this is the office where I spend many hours. And I've sat there hour after hour listening to dun, 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 dun. Hour after hour after hour, and it is torturous. Now, Baruch Hashem, the girls continue playing, and I can't describe many years later the tremendous satisfaction, the awe that I have when I hear my daughters play piano. It flows, the music, it's magnificent, it's beautiful, it's a wonderful experience. But here's the observation. On the piano, there are 88 keys. To master 88 keys requires such muscular control, such finesse, that it takes literally years and years to get the fineness, to get that control, to get the movements proper. The human face is guided by not 88 keys, but by 98 muscles. There are 98 separate muscles that cause my face to smile, frown, be happy, be sad, be anxious, show nervous expressions. And if you look at a person's face, you could read their emotionality. Vastly different emotions. Now, you and I never practiced it. You and I never sat and said, gee, how do I smile? Something like that. But you naturally know how to smile. When you're happy inside, a smile happens. But it's very, very subtle. You know how you tell whether someone's faking a smile? Don't look at his lips. Look at his eyes, because you see, when you smile from within, it's not just your cheeks that rise, but your eyes as well, and everything, your whole face lifts. But it's a very complex and very sophisticated processing of the muscles. You don't have to study it, you don't have to work on it. Hashem implanted within your body the wisdom and ability. When you feel sad, you show sadness. When you're happy, you show happiness. But you see, here's the point. Those are the outer manifestations. And when I show sadness on my face, you're seeing a vastly sophisticated system that manifests itself in the 98 muscles. But within me are those emotions. Within me are those feelings, the happiness, the sadness, anxiety, relaxed, satisfied, curious, interested, bored. All of the emotions are contained within the human. I don't have to think about them. They're natural and they occur. But when you begin studying them, you begin to find some very strange features in the human. You ever notice a cow can sit there in the field, graze on grass all day and be contented? They used to sell powdered milk. Our powdered milk is better because it comes from contented cows. You will not find a cow depressed. You will not find a cow showing up to a psychotherapist and saying, Doc, I feel there's no meaning in my life. Cows ruminate, they sit in the field, chew the grass, and they are content. But the human being is never content. The human being is almost never happy. You ever notice, no matter what, the human being has got to do more. If he's into power, he needs more power. If he's into money, he needs more money. If he's into position, he needs a greater position. But the human being is never satisfied, never happy. And it's a rather strange thing. If you're in business, you have to grow your business. If you're in academics, you have to publish. You have to grow, you have to change. If not, you get bored, you get complacent. Ugh. But here's the question. Why do you have to grow? Why is there such an inner need within the human to constantly grow, constantly reach the next level? Would you like to know the answer to that question? The answer to that question is because that's exactly what Hashem created us to do. Hashem put us on the planet to do one thing, to grow, to change the essence of me. And if I'm not growing, if I'm not changing, I will be miserable. Now that is the most powerful galvanizing force in the world. Unfortunately, many people subvert it. Instead of really taking that desire to grow and accomplish and really grow and accomplish meaningful things, they subvert it into other things. I'm going to acquire money. I'm going to acquire material possessions. And they try to fill themselves, they try to fill that desire for growth with more money, more position, more honor. And what they find out is that it works for a while. It feels good because it's quasi almost like growing. But after a while it passes, and after a while they feel as empty as they were before. If you would like to know the single most enjoyable activity that a human being will ever do, it's growing, changing the essence of me. Would you like to know why doing chesed, being concerned for another human being, is so satisfying? Because I'm acting like my Creator. I'm acting in a way like Hashem. When I turn away my own interests, and I look out for someone else's, when I act in a manner that's generous and magnanimous, I'm conquering half of me. I'm taking that nefesh abahami, that desire to take care of my own needs, and I'm pushing it aside. My nefesh asichli, my seichel is coming to the fore, and because of that, I'm changing, I'm growing, I'm becoming a different human being. That's what Hashem created us to do, and that is the single most enjoyable activity on the planet. If you'd like to enjoy your life, train yourself in growing, train yourself in accomplishing, because it is the most enjoyable thing you'll ever do. It's why Hashem made us, it's what's life about, and it is uniquely and powerfully enjoyable. Now, with that being said, there are some other feelings that a human being will have that are very interesting. If you would like to raise money, I have a suggestion. Build a building. If you need to raise $1 million, $10 million, $100 million, you'll find it very, very difficult to do unless you put up a building. Why? Because the only way you're going to get someone to write a substantial check to your organization is if they're going to put their name on the building. Isn't that curious? Why do they need the name on the building? Why does Lefrak have to have his name on the towers? Why does Morgenthau have to have his name on the hospital? Why does every museum, hospital, or worthy cause have to have a name right there on the front entrance? If you think it's about honor, only partially. It's much deeper than that. You see, within the human are certain understandings. Within the human, there's a knowledge that I should live forever. That's what Hashem created me to do. Hashem put me on this planet for a few short years, put me into this body, I'm here for a little while, but I, the one who's thinking, the one who's speaking to you, will live on forever. And I know that. But the problem is, my current existence sort of isn't forever. And I'm living my life so in this world, and I'm so caught up in the here and now, that when I have the opportunity to erect a monument to myself, when I have an opportunity to eternalize my name, there's an inner need within me to put that into a permanent form. Why? Because it hits, fulfills an inner need, the inner need within the human to live forever. And you'll see this over and over. The human being is never happy unless he's growing. The human being is never happy unless he has that sense of eternity, because that's what Hashem created us to do. That's why Hashem put us on the planet. I have one more concept I'd like to share with you on this thought. Arguably, one of the most pivotal Svarim ever written is the Shulchan Aruch. The Beis Yosef has a unique position in history. He is the first word in Halacha. He was the one who wrote the Shulchan Aruch. That is the basis of everything we do today. The Shulchan Aruch is very well known. The Kesef Mishnah is very well known. The Beis Yosef is very well known. But there's another sefer that the author of the Shulchan Aruch wrote that isn't as well known. It's called the Magid Mishorim. The Magid Mishorim are conversations that the Beis Yosef, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, had with a malach. Apparently, different people in different stages in history were offered the opportunity to learn with a malach. While he doesn't quote it in Shulchan Aruch, because Shulchan Aruch is hard, human halacha, he does in the Magid Mishorim quote many conversations that he had with this malach. And one of the conversations discusses a Gemara that's fascinating and very difficult to understand. Here's what the Gemara says. Tan Rabbanan, Shtei Shanim Mechsa, Nechlechu Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. For two and a half years, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel argued. Halalu Omrim, this group said, Noach Lodom Shalom Nivra. This group said, it is better for man to not have been created rather than have been created. Halalu Omrim, the other group says, no. Noach Lodom Shanivra, Yosem Shalom Nivra. It was better for man to have been created. For 2.5 years, it was a raging machlokas between these two large groups of Talmid Chachamim. Is it better for man to have been created or not to have been created? Finally, Nimnu Vagamru, in the end, they voted and they decided, they paskind, Noach la'odam shalom nivra, it is better for man not to have been created. Interesting Gemara. But here's the problem. Number one, it's probably the most depressing, downing Gemara you've ever heard in your life. You'd be better off not having been created. Number one, it's a very depressing concept. But number two, it sure seems that the creator of the heavens and the earth has a different opinion, because he made man. Why would Hashem make man if it's better for man not to have been created? How could Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel both agree that it's better for man to not have been created when Hashem clearly argues with that? And it's this discussion back and forth and this conclusion that the Malach explained to the Beis Yosef, and he explained as follows. All of the neshamas that will be born are created long before they're put into this planet, long before the world was formed as it is now. They're all up there in the Olam HaNeshamos, and they're there enjoying proximity, being close to Hashem, and they're there enjoying near perfect, almost pristine Hana, of enjoying Hashem's closeness. However, there's a problem. They haven't worked for their good. It's called Nahama de Kisufa. The Gemara refers to it as bread of embarrassment. Imagine a prince, his entire life, all he's gotten is being given to him, he's receiving, he's never worked for anything. Oh, it's grand, it's wonderful, it's nice, but there's a sense of, I haven't earned it. There's a sense of embarrassment. There's a sense of, I'm not really entitled to this. And because of this concept of Nahama de Kisufa, Hashem created the world as Hashem did and allows man to come into the physical world to earn his keep, to shape himself, to mold himself, so that when he returns to that world, he's now bigger, better, greater, but it's something that he's earned. And all the neshamas are there, and all the neshamas witness a neshama being put into a body. It's very uncomfortable for the neshama, but the neshama is put into the body and he's sent into this physical world for a short amount of time. He does his thing and then he comes back. And all of the neshamas sit there and they see this sterling, powerful, brilliant neshama. Oh, he was great when he left, but now that he's returned, he's so much greater, and so much more powerful, and so much more illustrious. And all the neshamas cry out, wow, if only we too could be born. If only we too could go into the physical world and get rid of this embarrassment, earn our keep, improve and grow. But not every neshama comes back so perfect. Not every neshama comes back so pristine. Some neshamas come back a little bit sullied. Some come back darkened. Some come back black. Some neshamas come back from the physical world missing limbs. Some come limping, some come blinded, some come mutilated, some come back diminutive, and the neshamas see both sides of the coin. They see neshamas coming back shining and glowing, and they see other neshamas coming back not very much improved, quite the opposite, damaged, dirty, and for eternity that's what they are. When the neshamas remaining up there see this, there's conflicting emotions. On the one hand, wow, to be created, wow, to be in the physical world, what an opportunity. On the other hand, it's kind of risky. On balance, the neshamas decide better not to have been born. It's way too chancy, way too risky. Oh, the rewards are great, but the risks are too great. It's not worth the chance. And the neshamas, given the choice, would say, don't create me. Leave me where I am. I'm very happy. I'm close to Hashem. Maybe I'm not as great as I could be, but I'm also not damaged. Leave me here. Hashem, in His ultimate wisdom, feels that for those who succeed, it's worth it. For those who make it back improved and better, it's worth the opportunity. And therefore, Hashem created the physical world, created the opportunity for the neshamas to come into this world, to earn their keep, and to come back. From the neshama's perspective, it's better not to have been born because it's too risky. Hashem, as the master, sits back and says, with ultimate wisdom, it's worth it for those who succeed. And therefore, the neshama says, don't create me. Hashem says, yes. But let's take one more step. What does the neshama experience when it's here? So the Mesillas Sharm gives us a mashal. He says, imagine a princess. Imagine a princess who's brought up on satin and silk, the greatest finery, every luxury, a parent's lover, and is nothing that's too expensive, nothing that's too difficult for the princess. Her entire life is absolute, total, perfect pleasure. At 19 years of age, she goes for a walk in the woods and somehow gets lost. And she starts wandering. And she's wandering further and further, further and further, further and further away, until she realizes that she's dead lost in the woods. And she starts running, and she starts running faster and faster, and the faster she runs, the more she's lost. Finally, she collapses in exhaustion on the forest floor. She sleeps for a few hours, and she realizes she's lost. She has no idea which way is the castle. She has no idea which way to go home. She begins walking and walking day after day. She's barely surviving by eating some berries, nibbling on some bark. She's becoming emaciated, and she goes on this way for almost a year. She can't find her way back home. She can't discover the path to the castle. And finally, after a year of sleeping on the cold floor, eating but bare berries and bark, she sees in a clearing a simple primitive hut. She enters the hut, and she sees that there's food. She wolfs it down. Wolfs it down as she never ate in her life. And she sits in a real chair, albeit not a very sophisticated chair, a wooden chair sort of carved out of wood. And then she sees a bed. It's a straw bed. This is the princess who slept on duck feather her entire life. She lies down in that straw bed and immediately falls asleep, the deepest imaginable sleep. When she opens her eyes, she sees something that fills her with terror. It's a man. She opens her eyes and sees a man towering over her, but he's black and he's ugly. And he looks down at her. And she doesn't know what to say. Does he speak my language? Does he understand my ways? Who is he? What is he? But the man doesn't say anything. The man leaves. And the princess notices that the man prepared more food for her. And each day, the man comes back from the forest with food, sometimes with gifts. He prepares some beads that he made for her. Day after day this goes on, and day after day the princess realizes that she's not going back to the castle. Eventually she makes peace with the fact that this is her lot in life. Eventually she falls in love at some extent with this commoner. They wed and they're married. Her life now is vastly different than it was when she was a teenager. And every once in a while she reminisces to the finery, the satin, the silk, the trays and trays laden with the finest delicacies. But the worst part for her is when her husband brings her a gift. And when her husband carves out of wood a cup and hands it to her, she begins crying because she remembers the crystal. She remembers the finery. She remembers her palace life, and is nothing that this plain, simple, primitive man can bring her. She's from nobility. She's from the finest. Anything that he's going to give to her is but coarse in her eyes. says the Mesillas Yesharim, that is a perfect mashal to us. There's a part of me that comes from way up on high. There's a part of me that's accustomed to such sublime holiness. There's a part of me that was dovik, that clung to Hashem, and there's a part of me that yearns for nothing but that closeness. And I'm put into this physical world in a body, and the body wants to bring me things, food to eat, drinks to drink, and all types of physical, coarse, plain things. My neshama within cries out, what? You want to satisfy me with a steak and a potato? It's so coarse. It's so thick. It doesn't fill me. The neshama within me is used to finery. The neshama within me is used to everything perfect and right. And you're going to satisfy it with this? If you like to understand the human, you have to understand your neshama. You have to understand your need within you to be generous, to be helpful, to be magnanimous. You have to understand that there's a need within you to grow. If you don't meet those needs, you will be miserable. Why? Because Hashem designed you that way. There's a neshama within you that cries out for meaning, for purpose. There's a neshama within you that cries out to give tzedakah, to care for other people. But more than anything, that neshama desires a relationship with its creator. When you daven and you open your heart up to Hashem and you really speak to Hashem, there's an inner sense of satisfaction, of joy. That voice within you says, "That a boy, wow, that was wonderful." And you're happy. Hashem created us to be happy. Hashem wants us to enjoy our short stay on this planet. But there's a real plan. There's a real purpose. When you use the pleasures of this world properly, they're tools. But when you use life properly, there's a joy, there's a balance. Your neshama within you says, yes, that's why I'm here and it's worth it. There's an inner glow. Life is beautiful, life is wonderful, and life is worth living.